Please welcome to everybody to the March 17th Public Works Advisory Board meeting. Please note that 4 of 7 members are here, and everybody out there in Morro Bay, happy St. Patrick's Day. Hope everybody's wearing green, and if they're not, consequences to those who aren't. Before we begin, a moment of silence. Okay, moving along. Have a motion to accept last meeting's agenda. The acceptance of agenda, not minutes, I'm sorry. The minutes from last meeting?
I move that we accept the minutes from the last meeting.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. So moved. Acceptance of minutes from last meeting. Any announcements? I don't think we have any written announcements. No, so moving along. Oh, we do have an announcement.
Hi, Jenny Brantley here. I'd like to announce that April 12th is spring cleanup week. So that's the week that you get to put some extra spring cleaning items out on your curb. And if you have questions, I don't have a phone number, but just know that the dates of that are April 12th through 16th, and you can call Morro Bay Garbage Services at 543-0875 to receive the extra pickup if you're doing a clean out of your garage or your home.
And with that, having taken advantage of this in the past, you can have up to the equivalent of 2 yards or 12 32-gallon containers. They shouldn't weigh more than 75 pounds apiece and be bigger than 4 feet or no more than 4 feet in length.
Right, and you put it out on the day of your collection.
Yes, it's very handy.
And with that in mind, I suggest that people try to reuse as much as they can of what they need to get rid of, maybe have a garage sale, make a few dollars. And last resort is you put it in the trash if you can't give it to somebody or reuse it yourself.
And going along with that, we have the waste disposal site here in town if you have any chemicals or paints that you need to, so don't throw that stuff away.
And that's open every Saturday from 11 to 3 at the Wastewater Treatment Center.
And I'm just going to jump on the bandwagon here because to reuse your items or even make a little cash at reusing them, you can sell them to your neighbors in Morro Bay the weekend before trash cleanup week. The weekend of April 10th and April 11th are the 2 days for the Morro Bay citywide yard sale. Very excited. So get your stuff out, sell it, recycle it, reuse it.
Remember, your trash might be somebody's treasure, and your cash, too.
Okay, I think that's the end of written communications or notice announcements. And so we move on to public comment period. We have a couple tonight. So, Mr. Smuckler.
Good evening, and thank you for having me tonight. I fondly remember the Public Works Advisory Board meetings. I am Noah Smuckler, and I am still a proud PWAB alum. And here tonight, on behalf of the Morro Bay City Council and Planning Commission subcommittee, focused on the downtown business district and enhancing the district's viability, we have for the last year been concentrating on how we can utilize all the visioning documents that go back 30 years focused on the downtown corridor to make it more viable and exciting for the commercial person or for the commercial district to just have more viability. And what we've been doing, the subcommittee is composed of myself, Commissioner Jerry Lehrer, and Commissioner John Diodati. And we initially started out, our direction was to take all the historical visioning documents that have been developed for the community or by the community, spreading back 30 years, and compile them into one resource that looks at common themes and ideas that were coming out throughout those different documents. And there were quite a few. Part of what we did was initially compile a list of as many documents as possible. Some of them have been officially recognized by the city, and others were more community-driven that are unofficial but still available. And that was a very large workload in itself, and as we were doing that, we realized how much of a workload it was, and also realized that there were further steps that we would like to take as a subcommittee addressing implementation of some of these ideas, and also checking in with the community as we currently stand, whether these ideas still fit, and if so, which ones were the most exciting and appropriate. So what we did was start to evaluate options that we might have to do that, to do the evaluation of the historical visioning documents, and also develop an implementation plan that included a check-in with the community. At that point, we found out about an opportunity to collaborate with the Cal Poly Civic and Regional Planning Department and work with a couple of their studio courses where they would actually be part of our workforce to do that work, working with the community, helping to facilitate those community workshops. And we developed a concept working with the departments after checking in with the Planning Commission and the City Council, and have brought back a plan that was officially accepted and funded by the City Council to implement a downtown enhancement project. And we are now at the point where we're beginning the work project and beginning the project itself. So tonight I would like to invite you and anyone in the community out to a couple of stakeholder meetings and also community workshops that are basically going to be focused on our downtown and business district. Some of the outreach that we've done has involved going door-to-door to the businesses down there and doing as much direct outreach as we can. We're planning on doing more of that. But we also want to open the invitation to the community at large, because we all have a stake in our downtown. And when I say the downtown business district, it's mostly the corridor along Morro Bay Boulevard and the Main Street, where the farmers market is, and so on Saturdays. So we do have a couple of dates that I'd like to announce tonight. Tomorrow, March 18th at 6 p.m. at the Yacht Club, is going to be our first meeting with our stakeholder steering committee, is the concept, and this is going to be a committee that's a sounding board for the Cal Poly students as they proceed outside of our focused and planned community workshops. So that's a bit of an informal meeting, just checking in with people that are interested in being on that committee. We've sent out invitations to business owners, property owners, and others that have expressed interest, and that's open to anyone else that would like to come in. On April 5th, that's a Monday, the Cal Poly class will actually be visiting Morro Bay for the first time. That's the first week that their quarter starts. And they're going to be doing a downtown site inventory and tour. And then that's going to be followed at 10:30 to noon with a mixer with our stakeholder advisory committee from 10:30 to noon on the 5th of April. Then our two big events where we really want to have a great turnout and a lot of participation are two community workshops. One is the 14th of April. That's a Wednesday. And that is going to start at 5 p.m. at the community center. So that's Wednesday, April 14th at the community center. 5 o'clock, what we'll be doing is taking a walking tour with everyone that can show up, as many as would like to, take a walking tour of the downtown area and really kind of set ourselves in the place of focus for the project. We'll be following that from 6 to 8 p.m. with an interactive community workshop facilitated by Cal Poly that will basically work to it'll present what they've done as far as a summary of the historical visioning documents, and then open it up for the community to have a really great discussion about what do we currently like about our downtown, what do we want to highlight, where do we want to go from here. And it's what's really exciting is the Cal Poly course focuses on community dialogue and interaction. So that's one of the key things that they want to highlight with their work. Then the second workshop, which will build off of the input that was received during the first workshop on the 14th, the second workshop will take place on the 28th. It's also a Wednesday, and it will also be at the community center. This one will start at 6 o'clock and go till 8 o'clock. And it'll basically be a presentation of and a check-in of what the information was received from the first workshop, and then moving forward from there, making sure that that is consistent with what the community's vision is. And then at that point, the Cal Poly class will go back and they'll break out into teams and studio teams that will take that information and develop different concepts that we could work with going into the future for the community. And those concepts will be presented June 7th at the Planning Commission meeting. During that period between the 28th of April and June 7th, our stakeholder and steering advisory committee will actually have some interaction as well to help make sure that Cal Poly, if they have questions or really feel like they need some more community input, that we have a group that they can access. Our plans also are to develop some flyers that we'll be putting up around town, and we are going to have an informal website for more information. At this point, those are just in the early stages of development. But if anyone at home or any of you are interested in getting more information, asking some questions, it's an exciting project. You can contact me at 772-7668. And the plan with this work is to get to the point where we have what we think is a good plan for the downtown area about where we want to go with that area, organized and focused around the concept of a specific plan that could be adopted and codified, which would be work that we would do internally, not with Cal Poly, and eventually implemented and funded. So that's kind of the process and the goal that we have for the downtown enhancement project. So I just wanted to put those announcements out there and invite you all. So once again, the two major community workshops are Wednesday, April 14th from 5 till about 8 o'clock at the community center, and the second is Wednesday, April 28th from 6 to 8 o'clock. Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot. No, a lot of information. It would it'd be very handy knowing that that would be a useful part of town to do some work on. That sounds really exciting. All right, moving along, we have a presentation tonight by the Citizen Tree Committee regarding landmark trees and the Master Street tree list. So once again, those at home, don't be alarmed if you see Mr. Smuckler on your television again.
Yeah, sorry about that. Good evening once again. I am Noah Smuckler. I'm the chair of the Citizens Tree Committee, which if you haven't heard about us, it may not, it shouldn't be a surprise. We've been unofficially active in the community for about 2 years. And so over the last year, we've really added a couple of key members and participants and kind of started to focus in on some needs that we feel the community and our urban forest could use. And what we are is basically absolutely citizens, unofficial advisory committee. We focus on helping to organize tree planting events, beautification of the city itself, supporting our city staff with care of the urban forest. Some of the members of our tree committee are local landscape professionals. We have a couple of nonprofits that focus on the beautification of the community, like Morro Bay Beautiful, and then citizens at large who are just really excited and interested in the urban forest, including our own Susan Shaw, or your own Susan Shaw, who is not here tonight, but really a great member of our committee. So what we have tried to focus on is, as we've gotten into tighter and tighter fiscal and economic times with our city budget, it's become more and more of a challenge to actually care for the urban forest with so many things that the community has as far as needs. And that's one of the reasons why we've organized tree planting events for our street trees and are going to continue doing that. And also, we felt like with especially the the landscape professionals on our committee, we could offer some resource for our city staff and government as a sounding board and council for decisions based on the urban forest. Now, I don't recall the date, but it was about 6 to 7 months ago, the city council, actually council member Winholtz specifically, brought up a concept of a landmark tree or a heritage tree concept that she felt was important for the community to consider because her concerns were some of the trees that have significant historical value or other values to the community. We didn't have a mechanism to protect them or give them a heightened element of review. So she brought that up at a council meeting, and the city council was interested in the concept but also not quite sure what to do with it exactly as far as the next actions. And they requested that our tree committee would take a look at it and consider the concept. So what we did over, we meet monthly, and we started to evaluate some of the other communities because this isn't this landmark tree or heritage tree concept isn't uncommon for other communities. And what we did was start to evaluate what other communities have done that has been effective. And what we have before you tonight is our recommendation for the landmark tree after about 5 months of work and evaluation, including running different concepts by our city staff. So we'd like to present you to that tonight. I'm going to ask a couple of other tree committee members to come up and talk us through our landmark tree recommendation, and then we'll follow that by discussing a recommended update to the city's master tree list, which has been the tree list that's used for selecting downtown tree projects or downtown street trees, trees in the public parks, and also as guidelines for private plantings as well, so people have a resource to see what may do well in our community. So with that, I'd like to call up Mr. Taylor Newton, one of our landscape professionals on the committee, and also tonight we have in attendance Mr. Wally McCray, we'll be teaming up on the presentation.
Hello. I'm Taylor Newton. So basically what we did is we looked at other cities, first of all, and what they do with landmark and heritage trees. And depending on the city, they use different terms, either landmark or heritage trees, usually the two terms most common. And then they define them. So that's what we started out with, was defining what is a landmark or heritage tree. And in doing that, that kind of gives you the what you would select the tree, specifics that you would, the criteria that you would select the trees by. And you guys all have what I'm looking at. And we came up with five main criteria, and each of those categories, it is still pretty broad. You know, you could specify it further, but the main categories would be 1, size and age, 2, local history, 3, aesthetic beauty, 4, an important species for bird and animal habitat, endemic and migratory, because we have a lot of migratory birds and butterflies. You could probably list more things. 5, important species for city landscape maintenance function. And a good great example of that, which is one of my favorite trees we were looking at, or a group of trees, would be the Channel Island oaks at the library. You know, they're not necessarily the oldest trees in the city, but they definitely serve a function and have history locally. So that was a good example. Plus, they're Cal Natives, which is something that we've been kind of leaning on with a lot of our tree plantings is Cal Natives. Due to water issues and maintenance issues, we try to choose trees that do well for their location. And but anyways, the first page is basically we went into the history of our local area, Morro Bay, and it kind of extends out into what used to be the rancheros around here. And you can go back 200 years and find uses of trees. And some of those trees, either by stumps or the tree's still alive, or the seedlings of those trees still exist today, either on the city streets or on private property or in the parks. And I'm not going to read the whole first page because I don't think that's necessary. But it gives you basically the history of, you know, Franklin Riley, the person who basically started Morro Bay. The first thing he did was he realized that it was way too windy and sandy to do anything in this town. So he planted trees. And so that first year he was here, he started a nursery at the corner of Harbor and Morro Bay Boulevard. And those trees, those eucalyptuses, are a lot of the eucalyptuses we have left today. Wouldn't be the trees he planted, but probably are the trees from the from those trees, you know, seedlings of the trees. And Monterey cypress were the other tree planted a lot of. So that's why you see a lot of Monterey cypress and eucalyptus. And the second page was a step-by-step, basically recommendation of how we would go about it. And the most important thing is that we thought that anybody could volunteer, you know, could nominate a tree. It doesn't have to be, no one specific has to nominate a tree. Anybody could nominate a tree. And so that would be something that's important. And then the criteria, that was the other thing, you know, when you review the nominations, we suggest that you would probably, of the 5 to even 7 criteria that we listed for further out on the second page, that you would want to choose a tree that had at least 3 of those criteria. That would be able to allow you to narrow it down, because we wouldn't want to have like hundreds of landmark trees. We'd probably want to keep it closer to like 20. I think San Silvestre was 22. And then the third page is basically our a little outline that basically breaks down all this other information into how we went about this and figured this out. And what we thought is that this was a start, and that with your help and whoever else's help in staff or city council or whatever it takes, we could take it to the next step.
Thanks, Taylor. And the next step being, we felt like the process from our perspective was that we built what our expertise was based on, and our review. We wanted to submit it to you, and what we foresee as the process would be your recommendations and input would be consolidated into this and then forwarded it on to the Planning Commission. They would review the whole packet, discuss, introduce their concepts that they thought were important, and then forward it on to the City Council for final approval or for their discussion as well. So you're the first step, and I know you probably have some questions, so we're available and extend our services in any way you think would be appropriate.
All right, I guess we want to open it up to questions. Would anybody like to ask some questions? I had one. Of those 22 types, are you going to work in your committee to come up with the ones that you want to have for Morro Bay, or are those already decided on?
Absolutely, they are not decided on. We felt like it was important for us to think about more how the criteria and the overall importance of a landmark tree concept fits our community. But we, as you see here on page, the bottom of page 2, we have some examples. Pardon me a moment. Some of the examples, one of our main historical documents that we use to identify historical trees and get a little sense of their history was this book right here, the Morro Bay's Yesterdays, which has great pictures of Morro Bay Boulevard and other parts of the community. So we gleaned information from this book and from talking with others. Mr. McRae has a real great knowledge of the history of the urban forest. And so basically we thought we'd like to put some examples together, but we didn't want to go so far as to say these are the trees that we think qualify. And we also didn't want to put something forward that was a completed project. We felt like it's very important for your board, the Planning Commission, the City Council to really review this and develop how this could be coded and, working with city staff, of course, put into a policy and regulation opportunity for the community to carry on into the future. So that was not our focus with this, and definitely is not our expertise and background as a committee.
You asked 22.
And you had mentioned the San Luis number.
Yeah, there was they have 22 landmark trees. So of all the trees that have been nominated in San Luis, they've selected so far 22 trees, and all of San Luis Obispo to be designated as landmark or heritage trees. And so for Morro Bay, I'd probably considerably less, because one of the good points to make is that Morro Bay, without Franklin Riley planting those trees and then people planting trees since then, we really wouldn't have a lot of trees here, because it's not it's pretty windy against the ocean. You would have to go down to like the Chorro Valley to really start seeing trees, or out there where 41 is to start seeing trees. So all the trees we have here are here because of people that live here or have lived here before us. And I think that was one of the greatest things that we were trying to go with this whole landmark heritage tree thing, is that the trees that people nominate are the trees that the people of our city value and want to be here for their children or whoever lives here after them, or trees that we value because people before us use them and they show the history of our area. So it would probably be more like, we were thinking, like, you know, start off maybe in the next couple of years, 5 to 10 trees at most. But the whole nomination and then review process would really be what would have to be defined. But getting people involved, that's, you know, people being able to come forward and be like, this tree's important. That's important.
I have a comment to make. I love this idea. I hope that they're called heritage trees. And I'm the president of the Morro Bay Historical Society. Our goal setting meeting is next Thursday night, and I will absolutely bring this idea to that group and recommend highly that it become top priority to revamp our Morro Bay Historical walking tour of the downtown area and to include the heritage trees that you identify on that tour. And we're planning what you mentioned, a sign or plaque designation for the historical sites as well as the trees that you designate. I think it's wonderful. I'm looking forward to finding out what trees get designated and to putting those on our walking tour and making that really a live activity for the residents and visitors of our town. So thank you for this. I'm excited.
Yeah, one of the sites on your, I think on the walking tour, is the old post office. And those palm trees right there at Monterey and Morro Bay Boulevard are still there. And those are, I think it's like 100 years. Close to.
Something that also is important to point out is that this concept at this point is focused on public trees, whether they're in parks, streets, or other public lands. We had an element in here that left it open for a private property owner that that felt like they had a tree that fit this criteria to nominate their own tree to be included in the program. We didn't really get into that too much because, one, we felt like we should stay focused on the public properties, and two, we weren't quite sure how complex that would be to attach a heritage tree designation or landmark tree designation to private property. We think it can be done, and it would be probably beneficial to have that option, but we didn't put a lot of effort into defining that element.
Yeah, all we said on that was that basically, you know, trees that would be designated as heritage trees on public land, well, those would be somewhat protected, and they would be proactively maintained. So they'd have a heightened level of maintenance by the city staff. And then the trees on private property, if somebody volunteered a tree to be a landmark tree on their property, they would still be responsible for maintaining it. And that was the main issue we had that we discussed on that topic, was that the maintenance of the tree wouldn't be by city staff, it would be by the private landowner. But as far as protection goes, you know, that would be difficult to define, like, how would we protect a tree on private property?
Sure.
Do
we have any other questions?
Oh, I just wanted to make a comment, too. Also, I thank you for all the work that you've done so far with this committee. There's been a lot of time and effort put into it, and they have planted quite a few trees already that are growing and healthy and beautifying our city already. So thank you for that. And I also wanted to, I had a thought about the private property designation landmark trees. I thought maybe at some level city staff could offer some consulting support. I know we can't afford to maintain trees on private property, but if people are willing to officially have their tree designated, and if through our criteria we determine that it is should be designated as a landmark tree, maybe somehow we could provide some kind of just consulting or some kind of support through the city to encourage them to care for their tree well and properly, or even through the tree committee. Maybe they could come to the tree committee and ask for some kind of help on how to maintain their tree, because somebody might absolutely love a tree and think it's valuable but actually not know if it's worthy of designation. So they might need to know where to go. And if it is designated officially, then maybe just encouragement to be part of that process. And then, you know, just how to care for the tree so it can, live a long life. So I know we're really focused on private property or public property, trees, and I think that's where our focus needs to be. But it'd be nice if there were some specimen trees on private property, if they could get some support through some part of our process. And then I just used a word that I wasn't clear on how you defined it. I saw a lot in here. You talked about specimen trees, and I wasn't quite clear what you meant by a specimen tree. How is that different than just an ordinary tree?
Well, that was a term that we kind of pulled from San Luis, because they have most of the definition for a heritage tree or a landmark tree for them would have to do with history. But they also have a section where you could select a tree because it's a specimen tree, and that would be because it's unique or it offers an element that no other tree offers. Maybe because of the way it looks, probably more because of its unique species. I would think that would be more likely.
So would it almost be trees that you wanted to afford some type of protection and designation to, but they're not necessarily old?
Yes.
So it would kind of include that group. And I do think it's important not to just have old trees in it, but anything, you know, things that are unique or somehow meet our criteria. And I think you need to have real clear, specific criteria on what trees actually will fit into this category.
I just wanted to add an idea that I've seen in other communities. When we do get this off the ground, a calendar.
Yeah, I really like the idea of the specimen trees, and I think you guys should try and work to include the private trees, because a lot of those really huge, cool trees we have in town are on public property. I mean, private property. I don't think it would be too big of an ordeal to try and work with a person who owns it to, I mean, if they want to designate that tree, they're going to probably take care of it pretty good. If there's some basic guidelines that they're supposed to abide by.
Yeah, and I'd like to add to that, the Historical Society is absolutely going to be working with private residential homeowners on the historic homes in this town too, so it's the same conversation.
And also, some people may not even be aware that they have a significant tree on their property, and if somebody in the tree committee or city staff sees a tree like that, I think it wouldn't be a bad thing to at least approach the people with the concept. You know, of course, there would be no obligation to buy into this whole program, but at least put the idea out there. Some people aren't aware of their trees. They may have bought a house and it has a beautiful oak in the yard, and they don't even think about it much just because it's not where they're focused. And so I think some kind of outreach might be appropriate as well. Never with any pressure, of course, but just educationally based.
One of the thoughts in our discussions as a committee was to be sure that the city wasn't in a situation where we were taking on the liability for that tree if it's on a public piece of land, just to make sure we're not, especially because of our budget situation, we're not extending our responsibilities or the liability that we hold onto those private properties. We have enough challenge with our own public land. So that was one thing that we thought was really important to distinguish with the private concept.
I think some people, though, might be thrilled to have that designation on their property as far as resale goes, real estate. I'm sure Heritage Homes sometimes will draw a buyer in, and maybe a significant specimen tree designated, officially designated, might also help them as well. So,
well, I can speak to that as a professional realtor. Mm-hmm. It's a double-edged sword. Some people will see a designation on a tree or a property as a valuable thing that adds value and charm and prestige to their property or their tree, and others will see it as a potential restriction to their freedoms. Mm-hmm. For now I can't trim the tree, now I can't cut the tree, now I can't hang Christmas lights on the tree or change the color of my house or put an addition on. So we have to be careful to some degree not to threaten the personal freedoms of private property owners. But I think it's a great idea to have the designations. I've seen mm-hmm. communities where the historic designation has only added value to the property.
Now, what would you guys like from PWAB? I don't think we can do anything with it, can we? We'd have to agendize it. Would you like us to just say we want to pass it on to council, or what would you like?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what the tree committee is looking for, is any recommendations that you have on improving this concept of the heritage landmark tree, so they can incorporate that language or those ideas into it so that when it gets forwarded on to the planning commission, that's contained in the program.
To do so, do we need to agendize it, or
no,
can we just kind of...
This is on the agenda,
recommendations,
so...
And, okay, no problem.
Yeah.
All right. So, I guess if...
I have comments, but it's more to do with the master tree list portion of this. So I don't know if that's... do you want to talk about that now, or do you want to finish the concept?
We can close up the landmark tree discussion, and we'll get into the master tree.
Yeah, so one of the things that, when I was writing it... So there's kind of like three different pages, and I thought that eventually it would go down to like one page, you know, and then eventually it has to go into the, because we have two documents that we have for having to do with vegetation. We have the one that with the coastal, with the vegetative guide, and then there's the public land. There's two guides to our...
We have the city's policy on major vegetation, which gives guidance on... major vegetation and trees on private property, and then we have section 12.08 of the municipal code, which regulates trees on public property. So, you know, whichever approach that we're going to take, whether it be public or private, it probably makes sense to get it all codified, so that we have this for the future, that it's more than just policy. It's really in our municipal code.
Yeah. That was the point, to have it be part of the code so that they're actually protected.
And that, I think, would be a nice, if you make a motion tonight to move it on to the Planning Commission, if you agree that that would be a valuable thing to have it codified and as part of the municipal code, as a goal for the process, I think that would help focus the discussion as it moves through, and let the Planning Commission and the Council know that the Public Works Advisory Board likes the idea.
No, it makes a lot of sense to do that, especially as we're moving up the ladder to put this into writing for the city for the long term. I see what you're asking.
I know there is quite a bit written to this effect, and I remember when I first read it, I thought it was code, but are they just guidelines? Is that the difference? And so it isn't enforceable. It's just a recommendation that we follow these guidelines. But when you're talking about making it codified, it would then be enforceable?
The public tree regulations are codified in Chapter 12. So those are all enforceable regulations. The private tree guidelines were adopted by resolution by council. They give guidance to what is major vegetation under a coastal development permit, and what constitutes, requiring a coastal development permit. So those are just guidelines to steer staff on, does a project require a coastal development permit for removing trees? For example, removal of two trees on private property per year does not constitute removal of major vegetation, so it's exempt from a coastal development permit. Trees under a certain diameter aren't considered major vegetation, so don't require a coastal development permit for that work, no matter how many trees. So that's really the difference in the two sections. Now, there are some, I think I could count myself among them, that it would help staff if we did have, maybe I'm editorializing here, if we did have our major vegetation codified so that everybody knew what the rules were.
I have one example that's coming to my mind when I read that material in the past. It's been a year or two, but I don't know if it was Chapter 12 codified or if it was in the Coastal Commission guidelines. But I remember reading it said any tree that is taken down by the city is to be replaced, which that hasn't been happening. So was that part of Chapter 12? And then if so, who polices ourselves? Because these are guidelines for what public service is supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And
that,
if we don't, then...
That is in Chapter 12.
Okay.
And it is, it's in reality based on the resources that we've set aside for that task. I guess we could write ourselves a ticket out of one pocket, and there's no enforcement procedures in that section of the code when we're dealing with ourselves. Now, there's enforcement procedures for if a member of the public takes down a tree and doesn't replace it, but there's really not enforcement procedures if we do it. And our goal is to replace those trees. I'm glad to be working with the tree committee to help us do that replacement. And it's really the only way that we've been able to do that.
So are we ready for a motion? Are we going to do that too, or
is it okay to break it into two?
I think it probably they're two separate items. So the heritage/landmark trees is kind of a new item that we don't have. The master street tree list is an existing list that we have that they're recommending modifications to. So I think it would be appropriate to break it up into two items, complete this one out, and then move on to the street tree list.
All right. Would anybody want to have a go at it? You want me to venture forth? All right. Then here's a motion to forward the recommendations that we have here from the Morro Bay Volunteer Tree Committee on the city's landmark tree program to the planning board and city council.
I second that.
June, would you like to add to that?
I would just say that what I look at here seems to be like a draft that needs to be refined a little bit more before this actual writing would go the next step to the planning commission. That's my recommendation, that it could be abbreviated some. I saw duplications of material in there, and so I would say I recommend in concept what's in here, and I don't know if you're asking for that, but I would say it just needs to be maybe cleaned up a little bit and condensed before it goes to the next step with some of the recommendations we made tonight.
But I'm seeing the recommendation being here on the last two pages before the chart, where it says Morro Bay Tree Committee Landmark Tree Research and Recommendation dated February 18th, 2010. And then there's A, B, C, and D. That's what I'm seeing as what you guys are proposing.
Yeah. basically, there's three pages, and they all, each page is the same thing. It's just in a different form. And basically, we were trying to just bring you a broad concept and get it narrowed down. And basically, I think now what we're at is that everybody likes the idea, and we need to take... So like he was saying, there's the vegetative guide, and then there's the public tree part. So if we're going to put landmark, if we're going to have landmark trees on private property, well, then you need something in the vegetative guide about that. And then if you're going to have landmark trees on public property, then there should be something in the public property, chapter 12, you guys were saying, right? Mm-hmm. So we would have this in two forms as would be the final document that would go forward, correct?
But I thought what I heard Mr. Livick say is that he would like to have the whole thing ready to go into the format of Chapter 12 codified version,
okay,
including the guidelines. Did I understand that correctly?
I think ultimately, I mean, that's my opinion. Mm-hmm. But I think to move this forward, really, they need to move this concept forward to the Planning Commission, and it probably does need to get cleaned up and made more concise. But before we move on to writing code language, which is probably more the staff's responsibility rather than a volunteer tree committee, that we should get buy-in from the Planning Commission and perhaps even City Council, then have the City Council direct staff to work on developing code language that would actually probably make its way back up through the Public Works Advisory Board Planning Commission and then for adoption at City Council.
One thought is to have it revised and that we could see it one more time before it goes on to Planning Commission.
Well,
this is our command.
Well, I'm hearing what you're saying, Rob. It sounds to me like before it would actually enter into code, we would have an opportunity to see the draft that the proposed code draft, and then we could vote on that.
Well, I think that could be way down the road. I'm thinking before I would want to recommend this report go on to the next step with our name on it as approving of it. I'd like to see it modified somewhat before it goes even to go to Planning Commission, because in theory they may not touch it, and then it could go to Council with our recommendation. And I just feel like it could be more concisely written.
What we would prefer is, because this is very much a concept stage document, and we really, our intent here is to check in with you, to check in with the Planning Commission, and to check in perhaps with the City Council on the concept to make sure that each of these very important bodies see the importance of this and the merit of putting effort into this. As a committee, we didn't want to be spinning our wheels too much in one area, only to realize by the time we get to hear from one of these other boards along the way, we're really not interested in that. And that basically would that would keep us from proceeding with this concept. And as a volunteer committee, we're sensitive to the amount of time that we're putting in. So we would prefer if you would give us the go ahead to polish this concept further and present it to the Planning Commission for their review. And as Mr. Livick pointed out, if we get okay from each of these bodies, then it starts back over again, and you get another chance to look at it. But tonight, perhaps what you could do is forward it on to the Planning Commission and approve the concept. So so it's clear you're not saying we think this is a finished product, but we approve of the concept of a landmark tree program within the community, and think that it would be valuable for it to ultimately be codified into the city code.
So you want to? What I was thinking is maybe you wouldn't officially bring it before us again before it goes to the Planning Commission, but you are saying you would probably do some revising to it. Well, maybe you could just keep us in the loop by sending us a copy of the revision before it goes to not that we have to approve it or anything, just so we can see it and be kept up to date on it before it goes to Planning Commission. I would be comfortable with that.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you even need our vote to do that?
I think that like what you guys were saying, this is right now what this is just trying to get everybody on the same page. And so if this is passed on and everyone's like, yeah, this is a good idea, let's do this. Well, then we can put it in a smaller form very easily that would then be able to go to staff and go into code form.
More concise before it goes on to Planning Commission, consulting support by staff if it goes to private trees, approach the private property owners to educate them on the value of perhaps their landmark trees. You might want to add that to your motion so that they can have those recommendations.
I think that's exactly right. And the only thing I might add to that is also have a definition of what a specimen tree is. So it's not all focused on heritage trees. Yeah, Rob, would you like to make that motion? Or Matt?
All right. I'd like to make a motion that we, Public Works, passes on this concept plan from the Morro Bay Volunteer Tree Committee about city landmark tree programs, passing it on to the Planning Commission with the addendums that we're making it this plan more concise, adding in the provision that may need to consult staff about private property trees, and adding definition about specimen trees. Was that?
I second that motion.
All right, did we get that or we need to repeat it? Okay, and all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. There you guys go.
Great, thank you.
Wait, we got part two.
All right, now we're on to part two. And for those of you at home, on St. Patrick's Day, you'll see Noah in his green shirt, and he's going to stay there. This is his third presentation tonight. All right, go ahead, Mr. Smuckler.
Another time. Okay, thank you again. I'm actually going to grab it. So, as your board is aware, our city has a master tree list that I actually don't know the year it was adopted, but it is very extensive. And is it part of Chapter 12?
No, it's not. It's in the city engineering standards, and it was adopted by I believe it might be in the zoning code, because it's really ultimately under the purview of the Planning Commission.
Okay. So this has been the list that any time a tree is planted within the public properties, it is selected from this list. And the format for the list is actually, as a committee, we felt like it's a very good one. Gives a lot of background information and detail about each of the different varieties of trees on the list. As a committee, we had concerns about the number of trees on the list that were either borderline as far as their performance within the community, or had certain issues as far as are they actually even a tree. In many cases on this list, they're more like a shrub. So one of the things that we as a committee wanted to do was to help refine this list a little more and focus it and reduce the number of trees on here that didn't quite fit into a set of parameters that I'll get to in a moment, but also to make sure that the list included some really exciting trees that we've seen perform really well in the community. So as we have it right now, there's a certain list of ideals that we felt were important for the city's tree list, and that guided us as we introduced new trees to our recommended adjustments and pulled trees away from the recommended adjustment. So the characteristics or ideals that we used as guidelines were drought tolerance, ability to thrive without water, that they provide bird and butterfly habitat and wildlife habitat, that they can thrive in the Mediterranean coastal environment, which is what our area is known as, and we felt it was important to include a opportunity to recognize agricultural heritage connections or trees to our community for this bioregion. You'll see in here that there are some fruit trees. And the last was definitely to highlight California natives as a real important characteristic of our area. The other things that we took into consideration as we identified trees that we felt would be good for this updated list were because of the city's and the status from the existing master tree list was the Yards and Neighbors brochure that was developed by the National Estuary Program and the Bay Foundation and by the Friends of the Estuary. Utilize the California Native Plants for the Garden, which is published by Kachuma Press, a really good book. This is the resource that we use for the graywater element, which is the new San Luis County graywater guide. And then we also utilize Morro-based yesteryears again, especially in the agricultural heritage component of what we've recommended. So let me check in with Mr. McRae. And then the last book that we used. Yeah, Wally really likes this one. He probably actually, maybe he. Oh yeah, there we go. Friends of the Estuary. That's, Wally's name's on the back of it. So, which book? This one. Okay.
And we have. We have copies of that book at 955 Shasta in our public services office, should anybody desire a copy of it. And it includes planting for the Morro Bay and Los Osos area, what trees and plants are appropriate.
And you also have copies of the new graywater guide as well?
Correct. And we have actually printed a few boxes of those that we can distribute.
You want me to say something? What did you want to add to introduction of water? I'll just give a little bit of history. Okay?
Oh, please do.
I don't know whether you guys know about it, but about 15 years ago there was a street tree committee in Morro Bay, and I had just retired from the Forest Service as a landscape architect, so I was put together with the street tree committee, and basically I ended up facilitating and coordinating a bunch of stuff about street trees. And that time Mr. Boucher was here and Mr. Beltier and these kind of people, which none of you guys probably know that or know them. But what we did, we came up with a street tree list. They did. The street tree committee came up with a list. And then who they were a bunch of Cal Poly people and a bunch of ornamental horticultural folks. And I was just retired, so I didn't know the environment. I found out later from Cal Poly that there's 10 microclimates in Morro Bay, which some of you know. I also found out from a lot of the horticulturists and also the city people at that time, there was a lot of different types of trees that will grow here, and a lot of them will not grow here. So we took a lot of the intellectual books from all over Cal Poly and all the other books, and they came up with this list, and I simply did a lot of the typing and coordination. And then we had, I was on PWAB at the time, and so we sat together, we put together this book that you see. And that book is a runoff of what the city eventually approved, because it went to the Planning Commission and then also went to the Council, and that was a list of street trees that we came up with. So it's been highly researched by a lot of people, and not including only myself, but a lot of other people. And as a lot of people pointed out, they came up with a lot of books to come up with this list. Now, the micro list that we're talking about now, that you may have in front of you, is a smaller list, and this list, as was pointed out, is trying to be a composite list. The first list was only drought-resistant plants. So that list that we see in that book and the city list, the prior list, was only drought-resistant. It had no, it didn't have a lot of natives. It had some tropicals, but a lot of it was like eucalyptus and a lot of trees now we may or may not use. But this last list that we're trying to come up with is a composite, a shorter list, and it has more research done to it, and we're trying to have something that we could just go out and maybe pick out of the 20 list of trees instead of a verbose list of maybe we had, I think, about, oh, maybe 150 lists, maybe down to 100, which was approved by the city, which is fine. But now we want to have a smaller list so people like you can understand it better and we can understand it and we all can do a better job. But so in front of you, I think you have a list, right, a smaller list that shows three lists that we came up with at that time. It has some bonsai, but it also has plants that will be native. So you can pick all native plants if you want. The heritage trees or special trees, you may have 10,000 of them in Morro Bay because it's going to be everybody is going to have an opinion about what they think is a special tree. There's 10,000 people in Morro Bay. You may have 10,000 special trees. A definition of a special tree, the Arborist Society of the National Arborist Society, American Society of Landscape Architects, we have definitions, but we're trying to do a community definition. So there are definitions of what a specialist tree will be. It could be based on aesthetics or composition or diameter and all this other funny stuff, but you've got to have a definition or you won't have any trees. Now, population of this size, we should only probably have about 30 or 40 trees, according to the American Society of Landscape Architects and according to the Arborist Society. Really, the arborist people are the people that kind of point this out, not the landscapers, because the arborist people kind of know what they're doing when it comes to trees and size and diameter and all that kind of stuff. But aesthetics is important and, you know, composition. But anyway, I'm done. Yes, sir?
No.
Yeah, I'm done. I can't hear anymore, so I put an ear in. I'm too cheap to buy one because it's $3,000 each, so I just put a cheap one. This is from Radio Shack at $89.
I'd like to...
Shop local.
I'd like to, if I may, just... I appreciate this resource. And, Rob, you said these are available at the... department there on
at the public services office at 955 Shasta Avenue.
Are these free for?
These are free.
And I just wanted, for the public who can't see the cover, this brochure is called a Yards and Neighbors brochure. I didn't know that it existed, and I'm excited for it. A Yards and Neighbors brochure. Discover model landscape plans and area appropriate native and drought tolerant plant species. Learn how to decrease garden-related urban pollutants from flowing into Morro Bay. Learn how to save 25% on your homeowner's water bill. And it's free. It's really cool. So thank you for bringing this in and showing us.
And you'll love the gray water manual as well.
Yeah, we got that, and I've been, yeah, it's good.
Something stuff that is important also as a committee, what you have before you is a very, this is just like the bullet point list of the individual trees that we think should be adopted by the city as the short list, the composite list. We as a committee are really interested in, we would not mind at all taking it and modifying it to fit the existing city master list format. That's not a problem. And for the new introductions, bringing in the new information so it's compatible with the existing list format. The other thing that we would like to do to help extend the this as a resource to the community is actually develop a small, either online, digital version, or even a printed version of a highlighted manual for each of these trees. So a citizen could use it as a resource. Our own city staff could use it as a resource about the different characteristics of each of these trees on the short list, which would have been really cumbersome to try to do on this long list. But with a shorter list, we'd be able to spend more time and highlight the different characteristics so people have a better opportunity to select the right tree for the right place. Because certainly we have trees on this list that would be perfect for one situation and other trees that wouldn't fit in that very same situation. So we would like to, if this concept is approved, to go back in and actually develop a manual resource for the community as well that included pictures and so on.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. Would anybody like to make a comment?
I'd like to say that I'm relieved to hear that you plan to put more work into this list. I feel like, I looked at it, and I thought my first reaction was I've seen the old list, and it was much more complete. And so I thought this really limits the selection. And if... And I see your reason for limiting it if you want to go into specific details on all of them and really recommend them, and I think that's important. But one thing that I didn't see here was a real clear attribute guide for each of these trees. Like, there wasn't anything on here indicate you have ideals here, like drought-tolerant, natives, habitat, but none of these trees are designated with those descriptors. So, like, there isn't anything here that tells which ones are native. So in the completed list, I would hope that your criteria for putting these, choosing these trees over the broader range, I know you've added, it looks like 23 out of these 43 are brand new to the list. So that means a lot came
up. The landmark tree process, we wanted to check in with, and this will follow the same process of the landmark tree. We want to check in with your board, the Planning Commission, the Council, before we started to refine this and make it more presentable, more understandable, and actually more of a resource for the community. So we agree with you on how this is formatted right now. It's kind of just a short...
I really think important to point out what your criteria was for choosing. If you have five criteria to be on the list and you decide that each of the trees that make the list have got to have three out of the five or two out of the five, then you need to say what those characteristics are. So when someone's selecting it for their home, they know what the advantages are of that specific tree and why you chose that tree. And that would also make it clear why you might eliminate some of the older trees that were on the list. I have a particular problem with some of the trees, as I mentioned to you, like palms. I looked on here, and I just did very brief research, but one of the palms on here that's listed is the California fan palm. And I used one of the books you used that was... out of your library, and it has some serious problems. I won't go into the details, but I felt they were significant
specifically
for that palm in particular about why it really wouldn't be a good tree to recommend. It made me feel like I just hope they're really well researched. If there are reasons, say two of the criteria very strongly make it a good tree, then that would maybe offset some of the problems with it. But I don't see that. The only thing I see on the palms is that they're groundwater or gray water friendly. And I think that's important, but we got to have more than just that. And I saw that a lot of these new trees on here are on there because of gray water tolerance. And I think that's important, but I think they've got to have other good characteristics besides that characteristic. And that each of the trees, if we're going to recommend them to the public or for our street trees, they really do need to be researched. And no tree is perfect. You know, every tree is, it's a living thing. It's going to have some issues, but we need to not ignore the issues because it has one good quality that we really like. Even if it's aesthetics or groundwater friendly or whatever it is, we need to weigh in the negatives as well. So I just hope this is thoroughly researched and that it can be rationally explained why one tree is on here and not another, that it's a logical decision-making process and that that will be clear to anybody that wants to read the list or use the list. Because I hope that people will take this home and use it as a good, solid guideline for what they want to plant and that the city will do the same. And, I mean... If you choose a tree that's poorly suited for an area, you could be living with a headache for 10 to 15 years before you decide to pull it out and try another one. So we don't want that to happen to homeowners.
And that's exactly what our goals will be, to develop that manual, that resource guide, and be specific with each of these trees so people can utilize that and do exactly what you're saying. Make sure that we're getting trees in the right place so that they can be long-lived and not create excess maintenance issues or problems with utility lines or whatever it is. So there are certainly, and you pointed it out, we as a committee have thought a lot about this, and it's pretty easy to look at any tree and identify a problem that it could pose to its surroundings if planted especially in the wrong place. So our goal with the committee is to help focus the community on appropriate trees and give the resource so people can select the right tree for the right place.
So with that in mind, are you guys asking that also you'd like to take this concept list as a work in progress up to the planning board? And so, June, with that in mind, how would you, if we make this motion, what would you like to see added? Because I see you're talking about criteria, well-researched. And so with that in mind, would you be comfortable passing this along, knowing that it's a concept plan, knowing that they're going to be doing further work on it? Because this is part of the tree committee, correct?
Exactly. What we want, again, to do is check in with each of the deciding bodies and also city staff as it follows the process, and then put more work into it. We wouldn't want to start to go into this list and do this resource guide that we're envisioning only to find out that half of the trees weren't included or a detail like that. We really want to make sure that we respect our own time and focus our energy in a way that's going to be
sane. One of the reasons that we were really trying to do this is because there was a number of people coming into local nurseries who had the list, and they were going down the list, and more than half the trees were no longer trees we would suggest to plant as nursery owners, because they either were not good for our local environment as far as being dirty trees. A lot of the trees were dirty. A lot of the eucalyptuses, you know, broken branches and stuff like that. And although they were drought tolerant, and there was a bunch of good things in that direction, they weren't trees that we suggest planting anymore. So what we did, what you're looking at right here, this list, is we started going, okay, what trees grow around us that we haven't planted? You know, like what trees grow down in the creeks, and what trees grow in our parks, and what trees do we see being planted around us that are, you know, it isn't a big list. It's a shorter list of trees that you see planted around us, and a much shorter list, and a lot of the trees that you see planted aren't on the old list at all. And that was the problem, that people were coming in going, do you have this tree, this tree, this tree? And I would say, or other people would say, you know, I wouldn't suggest planting that. I wouldn't suggest planting that. I wouldn't suggest planting that. What about this tree? And that tree that you did want them to plant or would suggest wasn't on the list. So what we did is, you know, we started going at, okay, what trees do you see planted around this area that aren't on this list? And what trees that are on this list do we still see being planted and grow well now? Because the environment is changing. And trees that used to grow well no longer grow so well. And then another thing we were really trying to go for is that this was confusing for people, because we had people coming in and weren't able to understand all this because they're not a biologist. And although this very extensive list shows a lot of research, it is confusing for the layman or the person that is trying to replace a tree they cut down. So that's why a short list helps. Now, there was the idea of two lists, you know, having a more extensive scientific list, and then a shorter list for just a person that wanted to come in and get a short list. And that was an idea that we had as well. But I think you keep on falling back on is that we're a volunteer committee and we're totally unofficial. So as we develop it, we need to constantly check in. And I think that's basically all we're doing is that, you know, these trees, we're all saying that these trees are the ones that are getting planted, and then a lot of these trees no longer, you know, a lot of these pines would not be a good idea anymore at all. And that's basically what's happening. And so, like, it's totally a concept. I mean, these trees we like these trees, but we like the way this old tree master list is set up. And so that's basically what we do, is we put more trees or these trees into this list and then have a short list that somebody could come in and get and understand. And so it's kind of like two things. You see what I'm saying?
Jenny, did you have something to add? All right. John, would you like to make a motion? You want me to make a motion? Oh, go ahead.
Just to continue the conversation, I think that a shorter list is a good idea. And I, like I said, I like the layout here. I think, though, it isn't clear, like you've got your ideals up there, and some of these have abbreviations next to them about why they're on the list. And I think that they each need to have at least two or three reasons why they're there. That would, without making it super scientific or anything, say it's drought tolerant. Somebody could look down here and they could see, or it's a California native they're looking for. Because you've got the ideals there on the top, but you don't have that, those ideals in the list here. You see where I'm saying?
Right. So,
okay, so
if it was more set up like the old list.
No, I think this is more user-friendly. It just needs a little bit more detail. Like you could, you see under ideals, where it says ideals, drought tolerant, you could designate with a D, okay? Or habitat, it could be an H. So it would give a little bit more information for the public why it was included on the list, and also for somebody more scientifically, biologically oriented to understand how you came up with the list. I don't know. I guess I would say I would agree and to recommend this go forward as a concept if it's written in a paragraph form, but not with these, not with specific trees on it, because that implies that this is the list. So, you know, like a couple paragraphs of written conceptual idea, but when you put it into this kind of list format, it's almost like that's what you're recommending. And even though you're a volunteer committee to do the research on all these, there's, I don't think there's anybody else that's going to do more than you guys are doing. Because that's, there's a tree committee because city staff didn't have the time to address all this in detail, you know, which might be ideal, but in reality, there isn't time for city staff to do that.
And not necessarily in this concept plan with specific trees per se, but just a concept plan of what they're looking for, that criteria, and then building as needed a specific tree list that would be handy, would be, which is ultimately going to be useful, more useful. So it'll be the concept plan with the, building the criteria and not just a specific list of trees.
And even if they wanted to include this, somehow they could say this would be an example of a work in progress, yeah, but it's definitely not the final list. And maybe that this format is more user-friendly.
So we wouldn't be signing off on it, but we would be giving these guys the leeway to move ahead to do this.
In creating a master list with some modifications again. How does that work for you?
Yeah, I was just thinking that if this would have had the little guide that we were talking about, well, that would have really explained why each of these trees is on this list. And
also addressed the interest of knowing which trees go well in which parts of town,
right,
which applications.
That's what it's intended to be, because the short list is supposed to be really simple, and then you have this guide that goes with it. So, like, if we added, I mean, we could add lots of more letters next to this that go back to a key, but that just makes it more confusing. And the whole goal was to have a short list that had an accompanying guide with it, and the guide would really give you the details in its short little paragraph for each tree. So maybe that's what it needs. It needs to have the guide with it before it goes on. Because that wouldn't be that hard. I mean, it's pretty much cut and paste. You could have a little piece for each of those trees, and that would explain why the tree is on the list. And how to plant it and where it goes and everything about it, down to the microclimate.
That would be good. I think, you know, you have some abbreviations with each of these trees now. If you're going to leave those, then make it more comprehensive or don't put them in there at all and leave it to the guide to explain those details. That's all. Because I, you know, You have master tree list designees on several of these, but I think far more important would be whether or not it's a native. Or so it just feels like it that could be cleaned up, that particular part. But we definitely need a master tree list. It'd be nice to have one that's in detail, and then we have one that's more general for a landscaper to be able to hand out to a home gardener. So
I'll try that motion again and see. All right, let me read it to you. Let's make a motion to accept this master tree list from the Marble Bay Tree Committee as a concept plan, asking that they develop additional criteria as needed for different sorts of trees, and not right now with just one list of trees, and build an additional list as needed for the future. Well, the motion would be to take this list from the tree committee and pass it on, that we accept it as a concept plan, knowing that we would ask for additional criteria be developed.
Specific criteria
to be used. Let's try and get this done. All right, well, here's a motion that we accept this recommendation from the Marble Bay Tree Committee, and to move ahead with this Marble Bay Master Tree List as a concept plan, to develop, and asking that they develop further criteria, specific criteria as needed, to determine what trees will be on that list, and not limiting to just one or 25 trees right now, but we'd ask for the further criteria to build that list as needed. Was that clear enough, Kathy?
Or no?
Okay. All right, so we have a second.
I'll second it.
All right. All those in favor? Aye. Now we're at a deadlock. So
what we could offer to do is to get into this more and develop the different details about each tree and the criteria that you're looking for, so it's more focused and more presentable to you. And we could bring that back and separate this out, call it from the two items, and bring it back here before it goes on. And then we can bring it back at a future meeting.
And if you think it would be helpful at this point, we could even say, in concept, we agree that there is a need for an updated master tree list based on this criteria.
Okay.
And
that
would
be helpful. So
would that be enough to move in concept that idea forward with the other part of the landmark tree? And then
you know what? Actually,
or do you want to just?
We should do this work, because ultimately we believe in it, and we were willing to do it, and it would be important for, I think, the council to accept this concept, and also the planning commission as well. So why don't we go back a little bit and refine this more and bring it back to you again at a future meeting?
Okay, great. Okay, and because it's written here, I just want to specify what you probably already are thinking, but it says one or more criteria. I think any tree on the list has got to meet at least a couple criteria. If you've got five or six things, one isn't enough.
Okay.
It needs to, otherwise the list, if to be included on the list, if it only had to meet one criteria, we'd have every tree around.
Okay. All right.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot for coming and presenting, and we'll see you in a month.
I think so.
Can I just add one other thing? I think that your resources that you've given us are a lot of helpful information. So if this added work that we're requesting makes the burden too big, I notice that you also have the goal to have an informal addendum guide. Mm-hmm. I would say that out of the two, developing the list more thoroughly, and, you know, that – don't ditch the whole project because the addendum guide and the list become too much. Focus on the list because clearly there's a lot of resources also that one could fall that tap down if they pick a particular tree. There's a lot of other places they can get more information about that
That's
specimen.
True. That's very true. Okay. Thank you for your time tonight.
Okay, thanks a lot. And do we have any further public comment? No. Okay. Moving on, we're on to the director's report. Open it up to questions from members. You want to start, John, if you have any? All right. June, are you ready with any from the director's report? Or
all good.
Okay. I actually had one about Rob, do we have any update on the water situation? I see our drought. Our water has been increased right now from, I think we were at last meeting, we were at 10% for state water, and now we're up to 15%. Have we heard anything further?
Last meeting we were at 5%, actually at 5%. Now we're up to 15% delivery. I think I reported last week that we were taking some state water. We have not been taking state water because we've had to, because of the reductions, it makes sense for us to bank that state water and use our local water resources. If we have to run our desal plant anyway, we should run it at capacity rather than taking some state water and running our desal plant at partial capacity. So that's what we've been doing, is running our desal plant at capacity so that we bank those state water resources for later on in the summer when our local water resources are limited, so that we can get our full allocation without having to have water restrictions during the summer and fall. Okay. We anticipate an update from the state sometime later on this spring onto what those ultimate allocations will be. We suspect they may even go up from the 15%, but at least we have 15% now, which due to our management techniques will allow us basically not unrestricted water use over the summer. I don't think anybody does unrestricted water use, but not the drastic conservation measures that we had to go through during the water shutdown last year.
Yes, okay. Well, all right, well, that's good to know. And now that I see in the talking here about mandatory water conservation measures. Do you have any number of those, or how can people find out about specific ones that Wither City is recommending to do?
The water conservations are were highlighted in our e-newsletter, I believe in the February e-newsletter that you can go on the city's website and to the, I'm looking at Janine to find where the e-news water bill online and see what your historical water usage is through the city's website.
It was very useful to me to look back at the last few years and see the peak months when if I had a leak or whatnot, and it did correspond with a leak I had, we had a very high month. So those of you can access online, it was very, very useful.
I have a question about that. That data for the water usage, is that by property? Is that by parcel number, or is that by owner who pays the bill? Like, can someone who has newly purchased a property research the history of the water usage on that property prior to their transfer of ownership?
This is a service that's being provided through finance, and I know that you have to sign up, and there's particular criteria, like you have to have your name, the address, the account number. I don't know if you're either like a tenant coming into the new situation or new property owner, if that historical data becomes part of it if you're starting new. So that's something I'd need to inquire from finance about so that we have that information.
I guess I could just try it out and see, huh? All right, thanks. Sounds fun.
And also one thing I'd like to note for people who may be watching, those of you who have been wondering about the Morrow and Chorro Valley well situations, I suppose this is an ongoing thing that the city is dealing with, Rob?
Yes, it is. It is still ongoing. We've been given direction from council to work with the existing Chorro customers and work with them on either council gave direction to work on terminating their contracts and getting them their own water supply. So that's the direction we're moving forward with so that to better manage our water supply.
Are property owners receptive to that idea in general?
Some are and some aren't, as you would suspect, but it's ongoing negotiations as to some property owners have agreements with the city, some do not have agreements with the city, so we're working through that process right now.
How many property owners are you talking about? And
less than 20, I believe. Historic water customers from outside the city limits. Some of them were due to trading rights to put wells on their property for water access. Some were along the pipeline route, so they were allowed to have a water meter there. It developed before 1964, when it was still a county water district, to the kind of the present day, and we're trying to clean that up.
Also, I'd like to thank you, Rob, for the street committee, specifically for work done on Bonita Street. I know I brought up at a few meetings about some holes on Bonita, and so I saw you the other day, but I wanted to do it publicly and tell people that if you have an issue with the street here in town, just call Public Works and let them know where it is, and they'll put it on the list.
And they eventually do get done. It may take a while, but usually what happens is during the wetter times of the year, we go out and cold patch to get it temporarily fixed because, you know, potholes can be a safety issue. So we try to get those fixed as soon as possible and then plan our hot mix paving when it's hot or warm.
All right. I think that was all my questions. Anybody else have any? Sorry. All right. Moving. Sorry. And this is new business, specifically the consideration of proposed transit system changes. Janine.
Burlingame.
Yes.
Minutes.
I thought we did. I think we approved that. That's all right. So, Janine Burlingame.
Thank you and good evening. As you mentioned tonight, you have before you proposed transit service changes to the Dial-A-Ride and trolley system to begin, or that are proposed to begin next fiscal year, starting July 1. So I want to give a little bit of a background about how transit is funded in local transit is funded in the city and what has happened to that funding over the last few years that has led us to the situation and the proposed changes that you're contemplating here tonight. The city, to go to the very beginning, in the beginning there's the Transportation Development Act. No TDA funds are used for the trolley service. The city had a management partners report, which was an assessment of city organization and financial options that was done a few years ago. And in there were two recommendations that were specific to transit-related issues, the first being to eliminate general fund support for the trolley service, and the second being that a recommendation that all enterprise funds, which include the Transit Enterprise Fund, which is for Dial-A-Ride, be a self-supporting fund. The transit funding for the state has been cut over the past three fiscal years. Actually, really, we didn't start getting notice of these cuts until 2 years ago, in April of 2008. That first cut occurred in the fourth quarter of fiscal year 2007-2008, and that was a cut of 12.3% to LTF. And this was sort of the beginning of the downturn in the economy. So as that's occurring, people aren't spending as much money. People aren't generating. So what's happening is not as much sales tax is getting generated. So it's a smaller pool of money, with which gets doled out to the various counties and then ultimately to the city. Then in the middle of last fiscal year, in December, we received word that we were getting a cut in that fiscal year's LTF, about 10% cut. In addition, the governor's budget at that time was also looking at proposals and ultimately was adopted to reduce the state transit assistance by 50%. And this occurred in the middle of the fiscal year, so you're looking at ameliorating these cuts over a six-month period as opposed to having it planned out for the whole 12-month period. And then finally for this fiscal year, we, again, in the middle of the fiscal year, learned that we were getting a reduction to our LTF at about, I think it was 12.3%. And we had already known, because of the budget changes to the state in the prior fiscal year, that state transit assistance funds would be eliminated completely. So that was already built into the budget. But the LTF cut that occurred in mid-year was not. Now, up until that point, the cut that took place in 2007-2008, the Council of Governments backfilled that with some discretionary state transit assistance funding that they had available, and they did that for the City of Morro Bay and the City of San Luis Obispo because both of our cities use 100% of our TDA for transit. And what that allowed us to do was be able to not have to make any service cuts for that fiscal year or make any fare increases. With the cuts that occurred last fiscal year, the city had received a Capital Rural Transit Fund grant for vehicle replacement that we got authorization from the Council of Governments to convert that to use for operations. So that allowed us, again, to have the Dial-A-Ride services be whole for the remainder of the fiscal year without any service cuts or changes to the fare structure. And ultimately, for this fiscal year, we ended up having to, because of the transit cuts from the state funding, we had to eliminate the Saturday service, and we had a fare increase. The cut to LTF that was occurring the middle of this fiscal year, the council had found some alternative funding sources. Some of it was if we had a sale of our old 1985 trolley that was being surplused, in addition to if we saw any surpluses to the Recovery Act grants that we had acquired for a vehicle replacement of a trolley, as well as using the general accumulation fund for the difference between the cut and those two first funding sources. So we were okay through the end of that fiscal year until last week. And that's why you have an addendum before you. After the staff report that you have before you tonight was written, the next day we received word from the Council of Governments that a second cut would be occurring in this fiscal year, again, because the estimates or the actual revenue coming in for sales tax was not coming in at that which was estimated originally and what we were allocated. So I'm not going to go into detail with the options of how we're going to or proposing that the council addresses that issue just yet. I'm going to go through the rest of the staff report, and I'm going to come back to that part. But just to let you know that as of last Friday, there's another little more than $24,000 that is being reduced from our LTF for this fiscal year, which has about 3 months left in it. And so that's kind of that's the transit picture in a nutshell. So since April of 2008, the city's lost more than $171,000 worth of transit funding, and this is for the Dial-A-Ride, just for the Dial-A-Ride alone. At that point, there's not enough funding coming in for the existing services. That's apparent. So what staff started to do was looking at some different options, the first being what, if we want to keep a dial-a-ride system, how far back would we have to cut in order to live within the state funding that we're anticipated to receive for next fiscal year. And what that came down to was reducing service to one day a week, and even that was with a shorter schedule of the day than what we currently provide, about 11 and a quarter hours of service with two vehicles. So more than 83% of our current ridership would not have any type of local service because there's just not enough seats and spaces within that one day. In addition, the fare box ratio would be estimated at 3.5%, and there's a state mandate of 10% in order to receive your funding. So that's not really a viable option, and it's not something that's being recommended. So one of the other alternatives we were kind of looking at sort of at the same time was converting one of the dial-a-rides to a fixed route, so creating a fixed route and then taking the other dial-a-ride, shortening the day, and seeing if that would be able to fit within the funding constraints that we have. And under that option, there would be a funding shortage of more than $287,000. So that's, and again, while the trolley would meet the fare box recovery ratio well above that, the dial-a-ride service wouldn't. So that's not an option that's being recommended. The third option that's looked at and the one that is being recommended is to eliminate the dial-a-ride service and replace it with a fixed route service. And what this would do is we kind of designed it to sort of mirror the existing dial-a-ride hours in terms of starting about 6:40 in the morning so that we could provide connections to the regional Route 12A and 12B at City Park and provide service until about 5:30 in the evening. It would be hourly service that would provide half-hour service to City Park for those connections with RTA. And the proposed schedule with it's basically what it would be doing is taking the trolleys north and downtown routes in the summertime, combining them into one route and making some minor modifications, moving a couple of stops that aren't being used, and moving them over and going up along Piney Way so that those people in the southeast portion of the community would have maybe 3 to 4 blocks to walk to the fixed route stop instead of maybe 7 or 8 blocks to get down to Main Street. And the schedule is in Exhibits B and C, and then a summary of the proposed fixed route is in Exhibit A. Now, since the dial-a-ride service would be eliminated, the mandated ADA, or Americans with Disabilities Act, paratransit service for those persons whose disabilities would prevent them from using a fixed route service would be provided by Runabout. Runabout is currently in operation. It's run by the Regional Transit Authority, and so far has really been kind of the backup to what Dial-A-Ride has been doing. Dial-A-Ride, since it just operates within the city limits, most of the trips that people are taking are within the city limits. It's less expensive than the Runabout. Most of the people opt to use the local Dial-A-Ride. But with that going away, the Runabout paratransit service would become the main source for that demand response service. Those individuals who would fall into that category do need to be ADA certified with RTA in order to use the Runabout. It is, my understanding is that it is not necessarily a general public, it is ADA. However, they do sometimes offer general public availability only if there are no ADA requests at that point. But there's more information on the Regional Transit Authority's website, Slorta, S-L-O-R-T-A.org, and that gives information about Runabout. It has the application so that you can take a look at it and see what are the steps that I would need to go through in order to become eligible and qualify. In looking at the type of ridership Dial-A-Ride has and making a determination of whether a fixed route might fit for that, over half the ridership are regular riders, so we felt that they would be ambulatory and able to use a fixed route service. For the little under half that make up the discount fares are for senior who are 65 and older and disabled. And it was in talk to maximize not just the use of the funding, but be able to try to encompass as much of the current ridership population as possible. Lastly, with this option, there's anticipated to be no funding shortage after you take into consideration fares and advertising revenue are factored in, and the fare box ratio would be estimated at a little over 21%, which is above the TDA required 10%. Now, what I've been talking about, this Monday through Friday service, would be the year-round service. In the summertime, we would have an augmentation of service where the waterfront route that we currently have would be added on Saturdays and Sundays, and then the north-south route would be added on Saturdays and Sundays as well. So we'd be providing in the summertime pretty much the same service that we have in the past two summers when we changed from one route to two routes and then had split that north-south route into three routes. And again, on Exhibit C is the summer schedule. And it shows the hours, and it's pretty much it's the same stops as the weekday schedule, so you're getting people used to the idea that this is the location for pickup, and the specific hours kind of mirror the weekday hours with the exception of just when it starts and when it ends, so that if somebody's taking the fixed route trolley during the week and then the summer season starts and they want to do it on the weekend, they've already kind of got the framework in their mind of here's the stop and then here's the start times. So going back to the addendum in regard to the latest cut to LTF that we received notice last week about, again, this is for this fiscal year, and this fiscal year has 3 months remaining. So staff came up with three different options for the council to consider how to address that funding shortfall for this fiscal year. And the first of which would be some type of service reduction for the remainder of the fiscal year for Dial-A-Ride. So once you take into account a minimum of a four-week notification process to the public, and the current riders of any service changes that would take place, and how many days are left in operation with that, and how much of the funding shortfall is. Basically, what would have to occur is that the Dial-A-Ride service would stop on March 7th. And what this would mean is that from March 7th, I'm sorry, May 7th. No, that's okay. May 7th. So what this would mean that from May 7th until the end of the fiscal year, there would be no local transit service being provided. And then once it's presumed that the recommended changes are going forward with the new fiscal year, that would start up in July 1, and the Dial-A-Ride would resume for 3 months until it would stop again, and then the new fixed route service would take effect.
Janine, can I cut in for a second?
Sure.
When you said there'll be no further service, but there'll be the fixed route service, but not the...
No, there will be no
local... So from May
local
7th on until the end of the fiscal year, we'll have no Dial-A-Ride or no...
No Dial-A-Ride, no trolley service. So no local transit service. The only service for transit would be the RTA regional route 12A and 12B. And those who are already ADA qualified for runabout, which I don't know how many of the current riders are in that situation. This is not a recommendation that staff is, or this is not an option that staff's really recommending, because you have this, you're stopping local service, and then a few months later you're starting it back up again for just a few months until the fixed route service gets started. And that just provides a lot of chaos to the riders. And they're already kind of having some anxiety about possible changes to service going on and what's happening. and it's just not felt that this is something that is really a viable functional option. So we're definitely not recommending that one. The other two options, one is having the council authorize the use of the general accumulation funds or the city reserves to address the funding reduction. And what this would do is backfill the funding loss, and we'd be able to provide the dial-a-ride service through the end of the fiscal year without any changes. And then starting next fiscal year would be the proposed service changes that get adopted. So on a Friday, dial-a-ride would end the last day of the fiscal year, and then Monday the new fixed route service would start. So that is the second option. The third option is if the council does, and comments from the board. Fixed routes tend to cost less than demand response or dial-a-ride type services because there are costs associated with a dial-a-ride type service that aren't associated with a fixed route service. For example, the dispatcher. A dispatching function is something that a fixed route doesn't have. For the dial-a-ride service, you have a person who answers the phone, takes calls, makes reservations for people, and dispatches those rides to the drivers out in the field. With the fixed route service, you don't need that anymore. And so that is a good chunk of the fixed costs, or actually it's a portion of the fixed costs that would go away. So what you see with fares is that fixed routes generally tend to have lower fares than a dial-a-ride type service because of that. On page 5 of your staff report is a list of the different fixed routes that are within the county and their regular discount and children fares that they have. And as you notice, they're all the same. And I think part of this is there was an effort for all the transit operators to try to be more consistent with fares, with categories like senior age and whatnot. The Council of Governments has done a region-wide fare improvement study in which fares throughout for the dial-a-rides and fixed routes throughout the county was looked at along with the fare media that was provided and a senior, what is the classification criteria for senior, for disabled, and so on. And the idea between some of the recommendations that came from that was the idea of consistency among all transit services that are being provided within the county. So if there is somebody coming on RTA that gets into Morro Bay, both taking a fixed route, they're not wondering, okay, when I get into Morro Bay, what's the fare going to be? Or I'm a senior on Route 12, but am I a senior when I get into Morro Bay? So we've been striving to move towards getting consistency with those policies. So what staff would be proposing is that the fare structure would be the same in terms of the regular fare and the discount fare at $1.25 per regular ride and 60 cents per discount ride. And with regard to other fare categories and media types and for passes, a day pass, a monthly pass, whether it be a punch pass or a pass that's based on a dollar amount, a student pass, that kind of thing, what we'd like to do is come back to the Public Works Advisory Board and the Council next month after we've done an evaluation amongst the other transit operators and come back with a recommendation for what those would be so that we'd have the full fare policies ready to go when the transit service changes take place. So with that, staff has two recommendations for the Public Works Advisory Board. The first is staff is recommending the Public Works Advisory Board review and provide comments as necessary on the proposed changes in transit service for the dial-a-ride and trolley as outlined in the staff report, and recommend the City Council approve said changes that are in Exhibits A, B, and C. And then the second recommendation is to recommend that the Public Works Advisory Board recommend the City Council consider the options to address the March 11th, 2010 memorandum from the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments regarding the fiscal year 2009-2010 local transportation fund apportionment reduction and direct staff as to which option would be implemented. And with that, I'll turn it over to the board for any questions and comments.
Well, Janine, can you explain option three again on the memorandum, please?
Option three would be to start the right now the current proposed transit service changes would take effect October 4th after the trolley season ends in next fiscal year. So the third option is to start those changes instead of October 4th, to start them May 3rd. So we'd be starting them in this fiscal year. And so what you would see is there would be a couple of months where the dial-a-ride service is no longer operating, but is replaced with the fixed route service that is talked about in exhibits A, B, and C. And so you will see some cost savings between the fixed route service and the dial-a-ride service for those 2 months that would ameliorate some of that funding shortage, but it wouldn't take care of all of it. So the second part to that is the council authorizing the use of general accumulation funds or their reserves for that remaining funding shortage, which would be a little over $5,000.
Correct. To suggest to the council?
Correct. Okay. And before we go any further, I'd like to just, the two members of the public, other than Council Member Snuckler, the two members of the public that are here, we have Susan Brown. She's the project manager for MV Transportation, who oversees the day-to-day operations for the transit services and the drivers and the dispatchers. And then there's Aileen Guillot with the Council of Governments. So in case you might have some questions for either one of them, they're available.
I have a question. Does Morro Bay have any private taxi service? Does anyone know?
I heard there's one now, but I just heard that in passing. I don't know if that's true.
I'm unaware. I know that we've had taxi service in the past. It's come, it's gone. I don't know if there's one specifically in operation at this point.
I checked on that myself yesterday. There's something called Surf Cab, and we see it parked at Highway 41 at the Main Street. And I called them and said, what's your cost? They said to pick up some in Morro Bay is $4 and then $3 per mile. And so they'll do that.
And when are when are they available? Every day, or do you know?
Didn't ask that.
Oh,
but
sorry.
It's Surf Cab, and it is sitting here locally. It's not like you have to call it in from.
So they're pretty much just specific to Morro Bay then?
It looks to be.
Oh.
I've seen them down there by the trailer parks right there. But, however, that could become very expensive, mm-hmm. $4. And then if they have to go to Albertsons and back, that could be, you know, a $10, $12 trip. So that could be a lot of money.
That brings to mind a question I had about the Morro Bay dial-a-ride ridership now. Mm-hmm. I think I understood that 52% are regular riders that you felt like could go to the fixed route without any problem. But that left 48 that were disabled and senior?
Correct.
And or senior, I'm assuming. And the disabled ideally would go to the ADA roundabout, hopefully.
Runabout,
uh-huh. But my concern was, what about the 66-year-old who isn't disabled but can't really walk four blocks to get to the fixed route? Is that much of our ridership, or is it, a very small percentage?
Well, I think what I'd like to do is bring Susan back up. She may have a better idea of the, you know, because she does dispatching and she's hearing the dispatchers. She may have a better idea of the group that fall in the disabled or the discount category, which are senior and disabled. And just because you're a senior doesn't mean that you wouldn't necessarily qualify for ADA. There is a criteria that's set forward. So you may be 66 years old, but maybe because you could not walk that 3/4 of a mile to the bus stop, that may then mean that you could be qualified for ADA.
We have an application for ADA, mm-hmm. that we've got in our office, and a doctor has to sign it saying that a person's got a disability enough to qualify for transportation. So it actually probably would cover more people than you think that call us because, as Janine said, they can't walk as far as a bus. So those are the ones that are going to have to apply for ADA, and they don't have an obvious disability.
Not yet. They
still
may.
They haven't used it till now. They've never applied.
But they may qualify.
They may
even
qualify,
though they're not
yeah.
technically disabled.
And also, there's going to be those people that are falling through the cracks. You know, they will have a difficult time.
I thought one thing that maybe we could do to ease the transition, because it looks like we have to go that direction due to fiscal concerns, is that in the transition period before we go to the fixed route on Dial-A-Ride, they could give out applications. We could provide some kind of assistance to ease people into that transition. And I think my thought, too, when we're looking at option two or three for the rest of this year, the longer period people have to adjust to what's going to come about, the better it might be. I don't know if the council would approve of option two, where more money comes out of the reserve, but I think I would lean towards that just because this could be huge to a lot of people. That, you know, this is how they get around, and they're going to be housebound, and at the very least, they're going to have to think about things differently if they're going to have to walk to a bus stop and ride a trolley instead of a nice enclosed van with a heater. And so I don't know. I just feel like the more time we have to get the word out to them about how they still can be using public transportation, to just maybe in a different form.
Currently putting together their budget for next fiscal year. How they are funded is different, a little bit different than how the cities and the county are funded. The cities and the county created entered into a JPA agreement, or JPA, a joint powers agreement, that kind of created the runabout, the regional service, as well as the funding mechanism for how it receives funding to operate. And so basically the funding for it comes off the top from the counties and the cities from our LTF apportionment. So if you're looking in the director's report, there was that memo from the Council of Governments, and that second page included a table of, with this latest funding cut, this is the amount of LTF available to the city. Well, if you look at that and you look at the numbers we have in the staff report, you notice that the numbers in that memo are higher, and that's because that is before you take out the city's contribution to RTA, the 2% required set aside for bike paths, and certain other off-the-top expenditures before you get to here's how much money is available for operations. So the RTA is funded a little bit differently. They basically create their operations budget. They create the revenue side of how much grant funding, how much fares, and then whatever the difference that is to come from the TDA, from the jurisdictions, and from the county. And so at this point, I don't know what their budget situation is and whether they would be looking at making any changes to the runabout. I think we won't be seeing their budget at the Technical Advisory Committee until maybe, I don't know if Elyon knows, maybe next month at the earliest we would be seeing something.
Could you hear me?
Question was, what's the total kind of total ridership?
Right. How many people might be affected by this? The 48% or approximately half the riders. Are we talking about 50 people, 200?
Are you talking per day?
Well,
or per year? Well, because the number that's in the staff report. Well, and it's a percentage of ridership for the month, and so it kind of extends out to the year. It really sort of stays fairly the same. So we're looking at somewhere about, I think, 35,000, 34,000 rides a year, and daily ridership, that's somewhere in the 150s.
Actually, more like 110
to
20.
Okay, so it's a little lower than that.
Riders.
You don't look at individual riders. That's what I was kind of wondering.
People,
how many
trips.
People,
that's
but
right.
But you don't keep track of that. You keep track of trips, right?
We do.
Oh, okay. So how many people then?
That's people.
Oh, I thought you were talking about trips.
I was talking trips.
So I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said then.
So riders. It's about 110 to 120 riders.
Total for?
A day.
A day. Okay. So if it's half of those that are in the disabled and senior category, that would be half of that number approximately per day.
It's a little over 50.
Okay.
And I want to add something. Just I think I heard you said about what is the trolley that we're offering, that you said maybe it's not warm. We have a completely enclosed new trolley that will be put on this route, so it has a heater.
I have a question. I heard you mention that the route was going to be on Piney Way.
Yes.
Am I missing something here? Am I reading this wrong? But does it go along Piney Way?
It would go along Piney Way, and we didn't really provide a map. This is just so the idea. You have the current route would be starting at City Park, mm-hmm. heading north mm-hmm. along on Main Street, mm-hmm. crossing over to the campground at Morrow Strand. You cross over Yerba Buena at the top.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're already all the
so
way up.
Come,
there.
We're
okay.
way up north. And then it comes back down south into the downtown, mm-hmm. Going to, I think it's Market, at the top of Centennial Stairway.
Via Main Street.
Via Main Street.
Exit Main Street, hang a right on Main, go up Main to Centennial, okay.
Coming back to, and then going back to City Park.
Okay.
And then heading south down to the State Park and campground in the south end of the town, along Main Street.
Along Main Street, okay.
And then coming back up would be coming across through Piney Way to get back to City Park.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And then, but I noticed there weren't any stops along Piney Way. So I'm
actually, we have one at that time point, at that time, at that stop. Otherwise, then they're not on time, and then you get into performance issues. But in general, I think we have somewhere about 10 minutes built into the schedule that may allow for that ability to do flag stops and still, make the time points to the next stop.
And then I have a couple of questions. Given the, so can you explain to me what the fare box recovery ratio is?
It is, it's taking your operating expenses and it's taking the fares and it's dividing the fares by the operating expenses.
And then my last question is, the proposed fixed route schedule, just get this clear, that was something that was already going to be proposed that we were going to be talking about tonight. It hasn't been agreed to. It was a proposal. And now on top of that, we're proposing that as well as a date change for its implementation.
Right. Originally, before last Thursday occurred, we had been working towards, and actually the staff report that you have before you tonight was designed to be proposing the transit service changes that would take place next fiscal year, that the fixed route would start after the trolley season ended on October 4th. So the Dial-A-Ride would start, would provide service for about 3 months until through the summer until the end of the trolley season. And that was what the proposal was. Then last Thursday happened, and we received notice from the Council of Governments that we're having a second reduction in this fiscal year to the LTF and needing to address that. And so that's where you have in the addendum the three different options that are also being under consideration, one of those being to start those changes earlier than the October 4th date.
Okay. Easy question. Is change provided on the trolley if you don't have $1.25?
No.
No change. Yeah, you need a quarter. Okay, you need to have a single and a quarter.
Okay. Currently, we have, for the trolley that runs in the summertime, we have a token that you could buy prior to your ride, or it's cash. For the Dial-A-Ride service, it is cash exact fare, or we do have punch passes at a discounted rate that's a per-ride basis. And so we would be, the thing that we would be developing, and we have recommended to come back to the board next month, is all of that. Whether, you know, currently we have a day pass on the trolley. So for the fixed route, would we want to keep a day pass? You know, generally you would, because most fixed routes have a day pass. Do you want a monthly pass? And if so, what type of monthly pass? Do you want it to be by day, or do you want it to be a punch pass by the number of rides, or a punch pass based on a dollar amount that you purchase, and so you use up to that dollar amount? Student fare, we currently in the summertime offer a youth pass. Do we want to have something that's like a school year youth pass, or just make a youth pass for the whole year kind of thing? So we'd like to flesh that out more and then bring that back to the board for review and a recommendation of approval to the council at your next meeting.
Any further comments?
How many trolleys do we have now, two or three?
We currently have four trolleys and three summer trolley routes. One of the trolleys, the 1985 trolley, has been surplus by the city and is in the process of being sold, so we really are looking at having three trolleys. So for the non-summer season, what I would call the winter season, one trolley would be in operation. During the summertime, when we augment the service for the waterfront route and on the weekend and the weekend north-south route, you would have two trolleys in operation.
And then I'm just wondering, are we not allowed to use the Dial-A-Rides at all to be on this fixed route? Or why are we using the trolleys instead of the Dial-A-Rides, and what's going to happen with them in the meantime?
The Dial-A-Rides, we were first looking at the idea of doing a fixed route with the Dial-A-Rides, but then as we started to think about what would be the route for this fixed route, it ended up, we already have kind of this logical routing set up with the trolley service in the summertime. And it's unclear whether there would be enough space on the Dial-A-Ride vehicles. They currently seat, I think it's 16 passengers without wheelchair, and if there are wheelchairs, then I think it's down to 12 seated. Whereas the trolley capacity is...
There will be a person without a job. There will be probably two people without any job, and the rest would go from full-time to part-time. So whether they can bear that is, you know, is not for sure.
How permanent is this supposed to be if we're going to wind up selling off the Dial-A-Rides and everything? And one day when money is around again, are we going to get money to buy new Dial-A-Rides or what?
Well, currently we've lost about $171,000 in the last 2 years of transit funding. And in looking at the LTF projections over the last few years, they have been going down. And the notice that we received from the Council of Governments is that the projection that was given back at the beginning of this fiscal year, 3 weeks ago, was adjusted to be lower, and then a week ago was adjusted to be even lower than 3 weeks ago. So if you want to be optimistic and say things are going to turn around and we're getting 3% a year in LTF increases, it would be well over 10 years before we see the funding loss made back up. And so it's that the funding's just not there anymore, and it's not there for the foreseeable future. So we're really having to look at what kind of transit service we can provide locally with the funds that will be available.
All right, and so with that, is there any further comment?
Just one. Do you feel like the runabout will pick up the slack for the ridership that can't make it to a fixed route? I mean, you know a lot more about this than we do, and I just...
Well, I'm not very familiar with the the runabout in terms of their capacity. I don't know if Alien may have a little bit more information since they get kind of the ridership statistics from everybody, if she has an idea with...
Well, runabout runs in the entire region, so it comes to Morro Bay to go to Los Osos, to go to Cambria, and already has trips assigned to the North Coast. So it's just going to be a matter of getting more people on the same van and making more local stops. But that's what the nature of a dial-up ride is, so you're grouping your rides.
Does it generally now run at capacity, or is there still seating as it's running now?
By law, the ADA program cannot turn down rides. It's, you have to meet that mandate.
So if Morro Bay was needing to have a lot more rides and the van was full, they'd have to provide another van?
Exactly.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Maybe they'll buy the dialer rides. It seems to me that I was intrigued by what you said, that the summer capacity would exceed the dial-a-ride vehicles anyway, to some degree. Is that what I heard?
Right. If you're running the dial-a-ride on the fixed route during the summertime, there on some of the routes we're taking 45, 50, 60 passengers per hour. And you know, there just would not be the space. So, you wouldn't want to, you know, in the winter time, use a dial-a-ride that may be able to handle the capacity. At this point, we don't know. I mean, with a fixed route, you may start to pick up more people than what you currently do on your dial-a-ride, because your dial-a-ride you have a fixed number of seats and spaces available throughout the day. So you may see an increase in transit ridership changing to the fixed route. But then once you change to the summer, we wouldn't want to, okay, now we need the trolley for the summer. And you get people programmed into thinking the fixed route dial ride's coming along and now summer's happening and the trolley comes by and they say, well, I'm just waiting for the fixed route dial ride. And you say, no, we're the fixed route trolley. So we don't want to provide that confusion. So the vehicle that you'd use year-round and in the summertime should be the same.
All right, yeah, I can attest to the trolley at times, having ridden it with my kids, sometimes during the summer, is quite full, especially in the back bay near the campground. So, Janine, what would you like from us, a recommendation for one of the options to send to council? Or
we have two staff recommendations. On page one of your staff report is the first recommendation, which is dealing with the proposed transit service changes. Basically, the Public Works Advisory Board, it's recommended that you review and provide comments as necessary on the proposed changes in transit service for Morro Bay Dial-A-Ride.
We can make a motion for the first one, which is, thank you. I'd like to make a motion that the Public Works Advisory Board recommend the City Council approve the changes to Morro Bay Dial-A-Ride and trolley services as outlined in Exhibits A, B, and C.
I'll second that.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those nay, it's unanimous. And now on to the second. Would anybody like to, before we make this motion, recommend option one, two, or three?
I'd like to recommend option three. This is a very, very difficult conversation. I recognize the difficulty of this conversation. It's major. But I see option three. I do totally appreciate the longer time to give people the time to digest it, but there's also the longer to worry about it, the longer to anticipate and fret over it. I really like the idea of assisting people getting their ADA compliance in order, workshops, whatever we can do to help those that just haven't done that because it hasn't been necessary. And it seems to me that that would be to get that happening before the summer and get that kind of going before the summer would be advantageous in many ways.
though difficult. That would just be my opinion.
Of those two, I agree with you, is that option one, for me, is not very viable. Option two, I don't think if we left it to the council, city council, to come up with $24,000, that's in these days, that'd be a hard one to swallow. And option three, it spreads it out a little bit. There is a disruption of services. However, there still will be services. And then along with that, the educational aspect of letting people know about becoming ADA compliant and helping the transition. So I agree with number three.
I have a question for Ms. Brillingame. Do you feel like May 3rd is enough time to do any kind of outreach and education effectively?
It would have to be if that's the direction that the council wants to go. It just means that becomes my focus the whole day that I'm at work, the whole week that I'm at work, for the whole 4 weeks. Because in looking at, could we actually really start up and do the changeover within a month? It's tight. Maintenance-wise, getting the trolleys prepped, it's just a matter of scheduling it a month earlier than they would for the summer season, so that shouldn't really be an issue. Changing over some of the information kiosks from the stops that would be eliminated and changed over to the new stops that are added. That actually, having that occur prior to the trolley summer season starting, it's just a matter of putting in a work order earlier rather than later to do that. The areas where it does get, the two areas where it gets maybe a little tight are with the promotion and advertising, getting all the brochure information changed, getting all the information on the website ready and changed. The issue with the remaining fair media that would be coming back to this board at your next meeting, but then would go to council at their second April meeting, would leave me 3 days to create, which most of that template can be done, but it'd be 3 days to create whatever finally gets approved, create enough stuff to get to the transit operator to start up for the fixed route service. The other is, if we have some drivers who cannot transition to the new fixed route and we have to recruit, I don't know if it depends on who comes into the office that has, whether they already have some type of licensing and certification where they've driven transit vehicles before, so you don't have to go through the lengthy training, education, licensing, certification process, or whether you'd have to start from scratch with somebody. I had some discussions with Susan Brown about that, and she seems to think that that most of the drivers right now would be able to transition to that, and came up with kind of a schedule that if we had to start May 7th or May 3rd, that here's the existing drivers and who would cover those hours. So it would be a tight, but it ultimately, if that's what the direction that the council wants to go, it's what we will need to do. But acknowledging that the council may have other higher priority needs that they wish to use those funds for, and have an inclination to not use the full amount for the dial ride for the remainder of the fiscal year. So kind of option three sort of splits the two, in that we would start service early, you would take care of most of the funding reduction, the small remaining bit of the funding reduction would come from the general accumulation fund, and that may be more palatable to the council to implement.
I'm sorry, I was a little confused about option two. It said that there would be the transition at the beginning of the fiscal year. So it would operate through the remainder of the fiscal year, which my understanding was June 30th.
Through the Dial-A-Ride service would operate through the end of this fiscal year through June 30th. Starting July 1, you have the summer trolley service that would start. The Dial-A-Ride service would be in effect for the first 3 months.
I see. Okay.
And that's outlined in Exhibits A, B, and C, that The Dial-A-Ride service would go until the end of the summer trolley season, when the fixed route would then start weekday.
I think that I would rather leave the decision of how much of the general fund to use to the council. But I would, my option would probably be to go with the kinder, gentler option number two, is what it seems to me, to give more time for you to prepare, more time for the ridership to adjust, even though I know that can also lead to more stress if there's more time ahead. But I feel like we could recommend too, but it's still the council's decision as to which way they want to go. When it gets to them, we're just recommending to them.
Could that we also go with, this is kind of sort of what June is saying, a hybrid, saying if we voted for in option number three, however we put in there, if council feels that they can use more money, would that help you in any way if they...
Certainly. I mean, the possibility could be that you start in June instead of May, and so you have that extra month. You have 2 months now instead of 4 weeks. And that just is a matter of how much more general accumulation funds or city reserves would need to be allocated from the council for that.
Yeah, so kind of whatever council's willing to bear of this $24,000 bill, if they're willing to bear that full amount, that would be the best thing for option two. But, yeah, we don't know.
Well, and I guess when I think about it, if staff came up with these three options, you must feel that option three is doable from your perspective, or you wouldn't have put it on there as an option.
We kind of had that discussion of, you know, if push came to shove, June, May, the difference is about $10,000. If we were to start in June rather than May, it's a little less than that.
Top of the 5,600?
Right. So if the backed it up and the recommendation is to start the services earlier than proposed, start it in June rather than start it in May, it's, I can't remember whether it was 97 or 9,300 additional on top of that 5,600.
Would anybody like to make a motion? Or? Oh, I'm sorry, John.
I like number two now, knowing that council doesn't have to go for the $24,000. I think they'll take a reduced amount maybe and give it an extra month. That's a really good idea, because nobody's going to be happy if we push this along too fast and what's supposed to be is not happening or correctly. That's really going to be bad. So,
and the other potential, which we don't have control over, is the runabout side and the going through the certification process. If somebody has to make a doctor's appointment, see a doctor, get them to sign off, and then once they submit the application, sometimes it can take upwards of a month, is my understanding. So, you know, if it could be something where it's June, or option two is the full amount going through and then having until October, you leave enough time to be able to do that. So that would be another difference between the two options, that the city doesn't have any control over the process of becoming ADA certified. We could help try to facilitate it in terms of getting information out to the public, getting the applications out, but ultimately the RTA is the one responsible for going through the applications, checking to make sure it fits, and actually issuing the certification.
All right, so I'll make a motion that we recommend to council that they adopt option three with the amendment that the implementation date is June 3rd and that the authorized use is $15,600, roughly.
June 4th would be a Friday. June 3rd's a Thursday, so if you wanted to make it either starting on a Monday, that would either be May 31st is the holiday, so June 1st would be the...
June 1st sounds like a good date.
I'll second that.
I was watching at home, so I've listened to everything.
Well,
it's up to the chair. There's a motion second on the...
Is there anybody opposed to public comment? All right. Please go ahead.
Hi. My name is Barbara Dorr. For the last 3 years, I've been a resident, 340 Arcadia. Right now, my legal address is in Redondo Beach. But my heart is here, and I'll be back as quick as we can be. But dial-a-ride services, I think when they were originally funded, everybody had to know somewhere along the line the funding was going to end. But communities throughout probably the nation have had the dial-a-ride services. They're a critical service. They're as critical as the baseball for the kids, the beautiful parks we have, Cloisters, where our four-year-old grandson goes. These are all critical things. I would recommend that if you haven't already, before you make a decision, notify all the riders who are using the current dial-a-ride so they have an opportunity to speak, send you an email, or give you a call and give their advice. I would also ask that you recommend to the City Council that they do an analysis and they look at the demographics of their community and they look at the funding that they give to recreational programs and the programs that are provided to seniors and see if possibly this is something. I guess you said 48% were disabled or seniors using the service. And, you know, in addition to that, it's the poorest folks, the folks who can't afford a car, who are going to be hurt the most and not have the services that are provided. We had a neighbor on Arcadia, always took dial-a-ride, came in, turned around. I don't know where he went, but I know it was critical. When I had, after knee surgery and was doing physical therapy right here in town, the folks that came to the physiotherapy center took dial-a-ride. They were dropped off, they waited, their groceries, their doctors. It's a critical service, and I wish I could go walking every morning with my husband, but I have a bad knee, and the hills up in the heights, that's nice that you go to Piney, but sometimes those walks downhill, and boy, did you make me feel old, 66. But it's true. It can be difficult to do those things. So I would recommend that you give notice before you make a decision to all your ridership. Let them speak out, not just the chamber for the summertime ridership. We've stayed at Morro Dunes with our trailer, and we used the trolley. It was lots of fun. And taking our grandson down here, it was lots of fun. But you're talking about Morro Bay citizens that badly need this service. I would just recommend that you look into it, have the City Council do a cost analysis. You know, wait a little bit longer. You know, carry it through. If it's the $5,000 or the $24,000, and then make a decision and be well informed and inform your ridership. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And well, to that, I mean, that's an interesting point, Janine. How have we done that public outreach?
There were rider alerts placed on the vehicles and at the dial-a-ride office, notifying them that there was going to be the Public Works Advisory Board meeting. We're also having a public transit workshop tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock at the community center for those who are transit-dependent and couldn't necessarily make an evening public meeting. We also had information on Channel 20 that it was announcing the same two meetings, as well as on the rider notices and the Channel 20 information. And Susan went out to some of the areas that have, like Spencer's, and there's a senior complex up on Elena, some of these other locations that they pick up a lot of people, and put noticing out there as well. And on the notice, it had mentioned that due to state funding cuts, that the city is considering transit service changes and how it would provide service, and is looking for input from the public for those changes. And then we also noted that the staff report was going to be available on the city's website on March 12th, last Friday, when it was burning tomorrow, would be forwarded to the council by the end of the week, so they would have that information available for their meeting on Monday.
Well, I agree. This is a tough situation, and no one takes it lightly. And thank you for coming down and speaking to that. That was impressive. I'm glad you were watching on Channel 20. However, I was glad to know that there'll be another chance for folks to go to the community center, and that's tomorrow at 10 o'clock in the morning?
Tomorrow morning, March 18th at the community center. I think they have us in Auditorium East. And we knew we were having two public meetings in the evening for the advisory board and the city council, but we also wanted to provide an opportunity for those who didn't have the ability, who had to use public transit to get around, and that would not be available in the evening hours. So we wanted to provide something during the day when they could use the dial ride to get to the public meeting and provide any comments that they had. Or learn about the changes. Some people, a couple of people who had called saw the notice, but they didn't see the staff report yet, and so we kind of went through. So tomorrow's public workshop is actually kind of going to be along the same lines as this. It's using the staff report, providing the history of how transit is funded in the city and what has happened to that transit funding over the last several years and the impact that it's had, and then the options that we've looked at to try to keep the dial-a-ride service, and if that wasn't working, what type of transit service could we transition to that would provide as much service as possible to the existing users. And for those who couldn't use the fixed route service, there's the runabout service, and getting the information out on runabout and the application process so that people would know, if I can't use the fixed route and I need a dial-a-ride type of service, this is the process I have to go through to get certified to be able to use this other type of service.
I have a question. Does the city have to pay runabout to be operating in the city, or is it a county-funded thing that then they go anywhere they're supposed to go?
The runabout service is the state or the federal-mandated ADA requirement to fixed route service. So for those individuals who have a disability that precludes them from using a fixed route service, this paratransit service is required to be provided. And the runabout is operated by the Regional Transit Authority, and they get funding from the cities and the county to operate service.
And this is a wild thing to ask, but is there any reason why we couldn't somehow or another pay the RTA to operate the dial-a-ride in Morro Bay? Because I know they're county, but can the city hire them?
Well, a dial-a-ride type service is your most expensive type of transit service. And the operating costs for runabout are probably equivalent to what the city's operations for dial-a-ride. So you'd be looking at having fewer hours available. You'd be in the same situation that we're in right now. We just don't have the funding for a demand response type service at this point.
All right, well, we have a motion on the table. Is there any further public comment? Come on up.
Barbara Doerr, I would just suggest that you take a small piece of paper, and what was it, 150 riders a day, that for all the rest of the week until the council meeting, that a sheet of paper be given to every rider and they be advised that the dial-a-ride service is going to be halted and they will no longer be able to take a dial-a-ride on-demand service. And then I think you might be able to hear from these people, put a telephone number on there, an email to you, Ms. Burlingame, or to someone, so that before the city council makes that decision, they have good input from the people who are truly affected by the decision. Let the city council deal with the budget. Recommend, you know, whatever you can. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, and that's an interesting suggestion. And I don't know, you said earlier, didn't you, Janine, that there was some sort of notice on the dial-a-ride right now?
There's a rider alert on the vehicle that notified them of the public meeting tonight, the transit workshop tomorrow, that there are proposed changes into how service would be operated within the city that are being contemplated. And we're seeking their input on that, and then information about the staff report for this meeting tonight, where it's available online as well as at city offices and the dial-a-ride office for people to review, and then get in touch with either Susan Brown, or more specifically to me at Public Services?
Well, that's a very good suggestion, and I feel satisfied that staff is doing all they can to publicize this and put it out there. This is a serious situation. So we have a motion on the table. If you want, John, would you like to change that to instead of a specific fund?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. You have a motion and a second on the table. You need to take action on that motion or withdraw the motion. If the seconder withdraws it, then you can discuss that. But you need to take action on this motion.
Okay. I'm the seconder, so I'll withdraw my second. And John, if you'd like to make a, now is the time to.
No, this is what it is, and it's going to happen, unfortunately. I'm sure everything has been done possible to avoid this, or I mean, we can't avoid it. So,
I think we were given three options here, and I would still go with option two because I feel like council can modify option two if they want to, but it gives ridership the longest amount of time to stay as it is, which would be until the end of the fiscal year. So I would have to vote against the most recent motion, but I think maybe it died anyway. But I would still say go to motion or option two because it gives the ridership the longest amount of time before the change happens, and council can still modify that 24,000 if they want to or change the date. So I would leave it to council because they know the, I feel like they have a better understanding of the bigger fiscal situation, and they may get more input between now and the council meeting from the public that they can weigh in on and then make their decision. So I feel good about option two.
Should we ask the councilman this? Are we allowed to do that?
I don't think you can comment, right? So, all right, June.
Can I make? I'd like to make a motion that we recommend City Council go forward with option two, as presented.
Yes, I'll second that.
Nay, but the motion carries.
So the vote was 3-1. Who was the dissenting vote? Okay, thank you.
Okay, so that finishes the new business. And we're on to the next agenda item, which is old business. There is none. Rob, on the next agenda, number 11, is future agenda items. Is there any sort of priority on this next one? And, well, Janine mentioned that we may be seeing this at the next meeting. So is there a priority on this next meeting? Do we know?
The next meeting, it sounds like we're going to have Fair Media coming back for discussion. We would also like to finally bring the bike plan back to the Public Works Advisory Board, and I know that there's a utilities item that needed to come back on a status. I believe it was a status on our overall status of our water issues. So we may have another full agenda next time. We seem to be flood or famine at the Public Works Advisory Board. Feast or famine.
Yes, feast or famine. Okay, so the next future agenda items were water conservation from Wade. We're talking about the transit system, transit service changes, and the bike plan, you think?
Yes, the bike plan is ready at this point, and it needs to move forward to the Public Works Advisory Board.
Okay, so that'll be for next meeting. Also, for those of you out watching in Morro Bay, there'll be a meeting at the community center at 10 o'clock in the morning tomorrow in room
Auditorium East.
Auditorium East to discuss the changes for the trolley and dial ride. So those of you who are watching the meeting would like to talk further about it or have your input heard, please. I know everybody would like to see you there. And then we have the last thing on there is a motion for adjournment. Yes? Yes? Oh, we didn't? Okay, I'm sorry. We'll go back to number 7, the approval of minutes from February 17th. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes?
I make a motion to approve the minutes from February 17th.
And I second them. All those in favor?
Aye.
And that's unanimous. All right, is that it? Okay, and so with that, the March 17th Public Works